Hello, I'm Rhea Blakey for Discovery Channel. Our topic today is the diagnosis, treatment, and long-term management of anaphylaxis. We'd like to thank the University of Virginia School of Medicine for accrediting the program. We'd also like to thank Day Pharma and Sanofi Aventis for providing the educational grants to make this program possible. Physicians and other healthcare professionals can earn free CME credit by registering online at discoverychannelcme.com and taking the post-test. All the graphics and references from today's program will also be available online. It's easy to log on, take the post-test, and earn free credit for the program, so I encourage you to check it out today. Now, we're fortunate to have a distinguished group of experts in the studio with us today to talk about anaphylaxis. Dr. Richard Simons, Vice Dean for Educational Affairs, Professor of Medicine, Penn State College of Medicine, and Governor of the American College of Physicians, Hershey, Pennsylvania. Dr. Vivian Hernandez-Trujillo, Director of the Division of Allergy and Immunology, Miami Children's Hospital, and Chair of the Anaphylaxis Committee of the American Academy of Asthma, Allergy, and Immunology, Miami, Florida. And Dr. Peter Perrott, Emergency Medicine Physician, Mercy Medical Center, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Doctors, thank you all for joining us today. During the next hour, we plan to discuss the following: how to accurately diagnose anaphylaxis in children and adults, the appropriate treatment for anaphylaxis in children and adults, incorporating the best use of epinephrine, additional therapies, and observation time, appropriate follow-up care, including prescriptions and referrals for patients who have experienced anaphylaxis, how to instruct patients in individualized anaphylaxis action plans for use at home and in community settings, and how to assess the risk and identify measures to prevent anaphylaxis in patients with and without a history of anaphylactic reaction. So let's start with the basics, doctors, and remind your colleagues of just how to diagnose anaphylaxis.
So anaphylaxis is an acute allergic reaction that is rapid in onset and may cause death. Different criteria are created. Number one, it is acute onset of illness that includes skin or hives, mucosal edema, or both, and then in addition has either respiratory compromise or decreased blood pressure. Number two is acute onset of illness and two or more of the following. So again, involvement of the skin or mucosal. Number two, decreased blood pressure. Number three, respiratory compromise. Number four, persistent GI symptoms. And all these are if there is a likely allergen. Number three is more in the case of a known allergen. After exposure to a known allergen, if there's decreases in blood pressure. So for children in particular, in infants to age one, it's systolic blood pressure below 70. Children from 1 to 10 years of age is systolic blood pressure below 70 plus 2 times their age. And in children from 11 to 17, a systolic blood pressure below 90. When looking at adults, it is also systolic blood pressure below 90 or a greater than 30% change in their baseline blood pressure.
I think these criteria are important for us to put in perspective, because many of us since year one in medical school were taught to think about anaphylaxis as a life-threatening emergency with choking, laryngospasm, and hypotension and shock. And we now know that anaphylaxis should be thought of as more milder symptoms in patients. We don't need to wait till we see hypotension or we need to see hives to make that diagnosis. And these criteria, I think, are helpful for us in remembering what anaphylaxis actually is.
And up to 10% of patients don't have any skin manifestations at all. And that may be for a number of reasons. Maybe they took some diphenhydramine at home and antihistamine before they came in because they had a little itching. And they may not even relay that information to you. Maybe it's in the operating room setting where they're draped for surgery. So there's a number of reasons why they may not have these skin symptoms. So make sure you undress the patient, do a full skin exam to try and find skin manifestations. But again, up to 10% won't have any at all.
This is analogous to the new definition of the sepsis syndrome, which is another important life-threatening emergency. And with the sepsis syndrome, you don't have to have low blood pressure to make the diagnosis of sepsis. And that's analogous to this situation, anaphylaxis, where you don't have to wait to the patient's hypotensive to make that diagnosis. That's good for the patients because early recognition is so important to get the definitive treatment.
And there's a lot of confounding variables, you know, when you're in the emergency department, even with set criteria, even if you know those criteria well. You have patients who are under the influence of alcohol or drugs, so they have an altered mental status where they're not able to give you a clear history. So that's obviously a factor. You have patients with psychiatric diseases. They're on psychiatric medications. That's a factor. In the extremes of age, of course, in the young children, they can't give you a real clear history. And sometimes in the elderly patients with dementia or other medical problems, they cannot give you an accurate history. So even with these criteria, the history is so paramount to making sure that we gather this information, put it all together to come up with this diagnosis, because it can be life-threatening. And Dr. Hernandez, you know, the criteria mention anaphylaxis, but a lot of us know this differentiation between anaphylaxis and anaphylactoid type of reactions. And is that something that is important at this point in time that we need to be concerned about?
So when we refer to anaphylaxis, it's typically an IgE mediated. We'll take a step back and talk, how does allergy develop? Allergy occurs through sensitization. You're exposed to something, you're sensitized, and it's upon re-exposure that you have the effects. The mast cells and basophils will release their different mediators. Histamine is only one of the many mediators. Anaphylactoid is a term that's been used for non-IgE mediated reactions. So it may be an opiate that leads to release of histamine causing itching. It may be the radiocontrast media where it's not IgE mediated, but it's non-IgE mediated, and it's still a severe and allergic reaction that may lead to death.
So what are some of the triggers of anaphylaxis?
Well, in adults, the classic ones are medications like beta-lactam antibiotics. Penicillin is a prototype. Obviously, bee stings, insect stings can precipitate anaphylaxis. And then, of course, we have food allergies, very common in children, growing in incidence for reasons that maybe Dr. Hernandez can explain to us. Food allergens like shellfish, peanuts, walnuts, cashews, those are some of the most common triggers that we see in adult patients.
Certainly in children, there are other food allergens that may cause problems. It may be early in life. Milk, egg, wheat, soy, peanuts, obviously, those are some of the big ones. But your allergies can also change with time.
Well, and there are other ones that a lot of us know about. Latex is mentioned often, and that's natural rubber latex. That could be gloves, pacifiers, balloons, condoms, also some blood products. So anytime when you're doing a blood transfusion or a transfusion of blood products, you may see a reaction. So there's things, including exercise. The common one that we see in the emergency department or in an inpatient setting would be radiographic contrast media. So that's something to be considered as well. So those would be other things that we need to think about as triggers.
And when I review the history with a patient, I talk about anything that they may have ingested in the last at least 4 to 6 hours, sometimes even further back to 12 hours, anything that they may have put in their mouth, whether it's a food, whether it's a medication, it may be ibuprofen, for example, any drink, because there's different things that we can put into things that we drink. So anything is fair game when it comes to anaphylaxis.
Well, we know that doctors like to learn from case studies, and as we've mentioned, anaphylaxis sometimes can be missed or mistaken for something else. Well, we had the opportunity to talk with Lulu, a young girl with severe food allergies. Now, her first episode was nearly written off as something much less serious, but since then, she and her parents have learned a great deal about being prepared in case of another incident.
Lulu is an adorable child. She's 7 years old, and she's very active.
I like ballet because you get to dance, and dancing is one of my favorite things.
She loves school. She's one of those children who likes to learn, and school is the perfect environment for her.
I have a lot of friends. I love art, science, music, and all the other activities. I love reading. It's also very fun.
Lulu is an extremely happy, very normal 7-year-old, except for the fact that she has severe food allergies.
The first time it happened, I was one. It was my first birthday. I was eating a cupcake.
And then all of a sudden, something was wrong. She was throwing up and breaking out into hives, which is a pretty dramatic reaction to a cupcake. The doctor put forth a number of different possibilities. She suggested that it could simply have been Lulu was overexcited. She also suggested that she could have eaten too much, and we didn't know the next steps to take. So my husband and I decided that we should go see an expert in food allergies.
How are you guys doing today?
We strongly suspected Lulu has a food allergy, so we performed allergy skin testing, which showed strong positive reactions.
So this is a checkup, right?
We also performed a blood test to check her specific IgE level to individual food, and both of them confirmed the diagnosis of food allergy.
We learned that not only was she allergic to dairy and egg, but she was also allergic to peanuts, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish. So in that visit to Dr. Lee, he gave us an auto-injector.
The epinephrine auto-injector is a critical piece of a treatment regimen.
Do you remember what these are?
The shot.
We have put together a first aid kit for Lulu that we carry with us everywhere we go, and it contains all of the tools we need to treat Lulu's food allergies. The first time we had to use the auto-injector, Lulu was 4 years old. We were in my car, and she was eating a lollipop, and she began to cough. I got concerned. I looked at her, she was turning red. So when we arrived at home, I carried her up into the house. It was definitely an anaphylactic reaction. My husband and I then made the decision that we should give her an epinephrine shot. After we gave her the epinephrine shot, she immediately was revived, and her coughing and her complexion returned to normal. That action, giving her the shot, saved her. Having the auto-injector with us at all times gives me peace of mind that whatever situation we encounter with Lulu, we can manage it.
I'm a pretty normal life. My allergies don't get in the way of anything, and I get to do pretty much everything I want to do.
Despite her food allergies, Lulu is one of the most enthusiastic children I have ever seen.
Dr. Simons, your thoughts?
Well, I think this video underscores the fact that anaphylaxis can strike a perfectly normal, healthy little girl in something as benign as eating a lollipop with obviously an allergen that she reacted to. So that means that the physician needs to educate both the patient and the family of an action plan, which we'll speak about later. Mm-hmm.
And I think the education part is so important. Even children, as a pediatric allergist, I think we underestimate the fact that we can teach children as young as two that if you're allergic to peanuts, say it. Because we know that the important thing is avoidance. To minimize the possibility of anaphylaxis, it's truly avoidance of whatever you are in particular allergic to. So my nephew Max, who has peanut anaphylaxis, I use him as an example. We taught him early on. He stated early on that he had problems with peanuts, and not only himself, but siblings, family members. So that's important. And I was very impressed by the family in this case. knowing they needed to use the epinephrine, realizing that, and not being scared to use it. So I think that overcoming that fear, which I recognize is something very overwhelming for families, but overcoming the fear and knowing I'm doing the right thing because this is the medication that's going to save my child's life.
Are there other ways to determine that a person is in fact experiencing anaphylaxis?
There are different tests that can be ordered. So plasma histamine, for example, is one test that histamine will increase in the blood 5 to 10 minutes from the time of a reaction. However, after an hour, it decreases. So in the acute care setting, it really may not be very useful. Tryptase is maybe more useful. So tryptase can increase within half an hour and usually peaks 1 to 2 hours. You should have a tryptase level if you're going to obtain it within 5 to 6 hours. But even that has its problems with sensitivity and specificity. We know that in patients, for example, that have food allergic anaphylaxis, it may not be elevated. So there's no perfect test. Really, thorough history is the most important thing. But these, and there's other investigational labs that are currently being looked at, different mediators that may be helpful in the future.